Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
This Sunday, the Reading Civic Auditorium is featuring the musical A Night with Janis Joplin. Local author Laura Joplin wrote a book about her famous sister, Love Janis. Later in the hour, we'll listen to that interview. But first, the recent eclipse piqued interest in astronomy, and in this first half hour of the show, noted astronomer Tyler Nordgren will tell us about the best places to view the night sky. His latest book is Stars Above, Earth Below, A Guide to Astronomy in the National Parks. Tyler Nordgren, welcome.
Oh, thank you for having me, Nancy.
There were so many sentences in your book that I just wanted to remember because they were just wonderful. And here's one of them. Whatever I may do in life, a small part of me will now be forever on Mars. Wow. How many people can say that?
You know, it's very few. But how many people also get to say they've lived their childhood dream? So this last week, Curiosity landed on Mars, and it has been such in the news. We're so excited about this. And on board is another one of these sundials, just like on Spirit and Opportunity that landed in 2004. So this really is a childhood dream come true.
Well, I remember you said that when you were a little kid, you imagined being on Mars.
Yep. I wanted to be an astronaut. And, well, while I didn't wind up being an astronaut, I am an astronomer. And back in 1999, Steve Squires, who is the lead scientist for the Spirit and Opportunity rovers, he asked me if I'd be willing to join this small group that was developing this sundial. And he knew that I love art and I love sundials in addition to being an astronomer. And so we took this small target. And normally this could be a very dry thing. When you land a camera on Mars, how do you know you're taking the right pictures? How do you know the colors are right? You know, here on Earth, we've got blue sky and green trees. So when you take your picture, you know, if those things turn out to be blue and green, you know the colors are right. But on Mars, we have none of that. So they needed to put something on the rovers that had known colors. And so this little target has these little patches of green, red, yellow, and blue with a stick in the middle to cast shadows. And that tells
you. And therefore, it makes it a sundial.
And exactly. We thought, well, gosh, this is a sundial. In fact, it was Bill Nye, the science guy, who came up with that idea. And so this group of us got together to think, how can we turn this dry little target just used for calibrating pictures into something that could reach out to people all over the world to help educate and raise excitement about the Mars program? And what a wonderful mix of ancient technology and 21st century know-how to be able to say there's a sundial on Mars.
And to know what it's like, what that sundial, what it means, what it looks like,
exactly.
And its function.
Yes, because you can look at this. And one of the fellows on this program, Woody Sullivan, an astronomer up in Seattle who's a big sundial fan, he generates this overlay that you can put onto the pictures to tell you what the local time, even the local season is on Mars. And so as the day goes on and you watch the shadows move across the sundial, you get to see the changing aspect, the changing colors. The sun sets through this red atmosphere, and you really get a sense of place and of actually being there.
Well, now, you mentioned a couple of names that people might have forgotten, and that is you mentioned Spirit and Opportunity, and those are names, and remind people what they are.
So those were NASA's first two big rovers on Mars. There was Sojourner back in 1997, which was this little bread box of a machine, but in 2004, Spirit and Opportunity each landed on different parts of Mars, and these were rovers about the size of golf carts, perhaps, and they were sent up there to look for evidence that Mars had ever had liquid water on their surface. Because when we think about, well, every form of life that we know of here on Earth requires three things: liquid water, some kind of energy source, usually the sun, or it could be a volcano, and then organic molecules. Well, we knew that Mars gets sunlight and that there used to be volcanoes on Mars. So what we really needed was evidence that there'd ever been liquid water, because today it's too cold. And so Spirit and Opportunity went, they're like roving geologists looking for evidence that Mars had once been warmer and wetter, and they found it. They actually found evidence that water had once flowed across the surface of Mars. So that was their big discovery. And now, and here's one thing I just find amazing. They were supposed to last for only 90 Martian days. Well, Spirit lasted for about 6 years, And Opportunity, at this point, 8 years later, is still going strong. So Curiosity, which just landed, it's supposed to last for 2 years. So imagine how long it might last if all goes well. So it's a really exciting time.
Well, this period of time is not very long, but in terms of technology, there is a rather difference in when Spirit and Opportunity were launched and when the most recent, when Curiosity. What is one of the differences now?
The big difference has been the rise of social media, Facebook. Back in 2004, when Spirit and Opportunity landed, I was watching on NASA TV back at home. I could go to my front door and look up and see Mars in the sky. But really, the landing, as exciting as it was, I experienced it on my own. I went and sent out a few emails the next morning, updated my web page, but that was about it. On Sunday night, when Curiosity landed, I was again at home, and I again could see Mars out the window. But this time, I was on Facebook. I had friends all over the world that we were all commenting in real time about what we were seeing, how we were feeling, what we were experiencing. And so today, when Curiosity landed, as Curiosity is about to set out and explore Mars, this is something that everyone can take part in real time. It is utterly unlike anything that's ever happened before.
My guest is astronomer Tyler Nordgren, and we're going to be talking about his book, Stars Above, Earth Below, A Guide to Astronomy in the National Parks. But he also played a role with the Mars rover, and so that is something that is so fascinating and so exciting for those of us who are not astronomers to be involved. And like you're saying, with social media now, we all feel a part of this.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, on the website, the rover, they post raw images there. So you, as those raw images come down and they're released, anybody can go on, get them, put them on Facebook. NASA images are free for everyone to use because, well, it's NASA. It's paid for by your and my tax dollars. So there are images. It's our rover.
Well, for those of us who, well, you imagined actually setting foot on Mars, but you actually have done the next best thing, and that is there are places here on Earth that are very similar to Mars.
Exactly. A couple that come to mind is, well, Death Valley. Just yesterday morning at the NASA press conference, the lead scientist, John Grotzinger, mentioned that the first images we were getting back from Curiosity looked exactly like maybe we'd surreptitiously taken the rover out into Death Valley and started taking pictures there.
Trying to palm them off as taken from outer space.
Exactly. Yeah. And I have to admit, when I saw those first images, I thought, that looks so much like Death Valley. And so that's one of the things that I do is I travel around the country going to national parks, is sharing with people that astronomy doesn't just end when the sun comes up. Look around at the landscape. The Earth is a planet. It's the nearest planet to you. So the processes, the geology, the things that go on to shape our surface are also at work on the other planets and moons in the solar system.
In fact, I hadn't really thought about that until I was talking to a friend who is a geologist, and I mentioned to her that I was excited about interviewing an astronomer, and I found out she had taught astronomy before. Because I hadn't realized when I read your book, I began to say, oh, well, of course, this all makes sense, that there really isn't this big divide between geologists and astronomers.
Mm-hmm. Yep. The intersection between geology and astronomy is what's called planetary science. And it's an incredibly strong, vibrant field, bringing these two expertise together to look at the other planets and moons in our solar system and be able to say, how is the Earth similar to or different from these? How has the Earth gotten here? Because, in fact, I mean, that's the question that we all want to answer. How did we get here? How did the Earth get to be this life-sustaining, wonderful planet? And so by looking at Mars and Venus and the Moon and these other worlds, you can say, well, here's what happened if the Earth had been a little smaller. Or here's what would have happened if the Earth had been a little farther from the sun or a little closer to the sun in the case of Venus. Venus and the Earth are twin planets. But there you have this runaway greenhouse effect that has created a surface with a temperature of 800 degrees, able to boil and melt lead. So how did we avoid that? And that's what planetary science tells us.
In fact, you call us the Goldilocks planet.
Exactly. Venus is a little too hot, a little too close. Mars is a little too small and a little too far away. So if nature had just been a little different, we could have gone down one of these two different paths. And so when we look forward to the future, well, if we know what's happened in the past and how we got here, we can better plan for what we're going to do with our future.
My guest is astronomer Tyler Nordgren, and his book is Stars Above, Earth Below, A Guide to Astronomy in the National Parks. And so you were describing trips that you make out of the national parks, and as you walk around, you're wondering, is this like what Mars is? What is the ground like in Mars? And you wonder about these things, and you look down at the ground and wonder, is this what it's like?
Yeah. Go out to Utah or northern Arizona, red rock country. Well, it's red rock country for the same reason that Mars is red. You have iron in the rocks that's reacted with oxygen in the atmosphere to form rust. So yeah, when you're out there hiking in Arches, say, Arches National Park, you can really wonder, are there arches on Mars? And some of the images that we're seeing indicate that there are some natural bridges, something like this perhaps. And as we're getting better and better images, we see things that look like buttes like you might have in Monument Valley. So one of the things I share with my readers is take a look at a picture, take a look at someplace like Arches, and imagine step by step taking away that lovely blue sky, taking away every trace of water that's now active on the surface, get rid of all vegetation, and think about what would these things do? And pretty soon, you can imagine yourself standing on the surface of Mars.
Well, now, you did say water on the surface. And why did you make that distinction? Why didn't you just say water?
Well, on Mars, we know that there's water there.
Now, wait right there, because maybe not everybody knows that.
Okay. Well, a couple years ago, NASA landed the Phoenix lander up near the poles of Mars. And Phoenix was able to dig a little hole down into the ground. And when it first revealed the bottom of this hole, there was ice, water ice, at the bottom of the hole. Now, right now, it's too cold and the pressure is too low on Mars for that ice to stay there. And so the ice quickly, what's called sublimated, it turned into a gas. And because of the low temperature and pressure, water can no longer flow across the surface of Mars. But we do know from Spirit and Opportunity that they did detect that at some point in Mars's past, it was warmer and wetter. And so you could actually have had pools and streams, actual liquid water on the surface of Mars. So imagine going out someplace like Great Salt Lake in Utah, and to stand along the shores of Great Salt Lake, that might have been what it was like to stand on Mars at some point in the past. And we know that everywhere that you find liquid water on Earth and sunlight and organic molecules, we have life here on Earth. So that's why we're going to Mars. And that's what Curiosity is looking for. It's looking for that third thing, those organic molecules. If it finds that those were there, but that there was no life, you know, if we subsequently find out that there was no life there at all, well, that'll tell us something really important, because here is the most Earth-like place that we possibly know of. And if there was never life there, then that means that life here on Earth is so precious and so rare. And if we do find that there was once ever life on Mars, well, that tells us something even more profound. There could be life throughout the universe. We currently know of almost 1,000 planets orbiting other stars. So I mean, we are now just one planet amongst this ever-growing family of planets. And if you can have two places in the same solar system where life has evolved, imagine how much life there could be out there in the universe.
My guest is astronomer Tyler Nordgren, and his book is Stars Above, Earth Below, A Guide to Astronomy in the National Parks. And when I first looked at the cover and the title of your book, I thought, in the national parks. So tell us how you came to write this particular book, why you think we should look at in the national parks.
Well, my university, University of Redlands in Southern California, I'm in the Los Angeles basin. When I look up and I look at a clear night sky, I really can count all 12 stars up there. It is that bad. And so when I would start talking to my students, I ask, had you ever seen the Milky Way? I'll get maybe two or three hands going up. And when I'd ask them, well, where did you see the Milky Way? Usually it was a family vacation to someplace like the Grand Canyon or Yosemite. So that got me thinking. And about a year after this happened, I was up at Yosemite. I had just gotten tenure. I was on a vacation. And I went and I did what millions of visitors do every year. I went to the Evening Ranger program. And it happened to be an astronomy talk. And I thought, well, I like astronomy. And I noticed something. I noticed that in this amphitheater, there were 100 other people. I know I like astronomy. I didn't realize this many other people liked astronomy. And as the park ranger began talking about what you could see in the parks, the Milky Way and the stars, I heard oohs and ahs around me. And later, as it got dark and the stars came out, again, there were oohs and ahs. And I realized these people are seeing something that they cannot see at home. And we think of people going to the national parks to see waterfalls and the wildlife and grizzly bears. But some internal polling done by the Park Service has shown that a starry sky, being able to see the Milky Way, is now as integral to a park experience as waterfalls and wildlife. And so I made my decision at that point that rather than go on and write a few papers on star formation and dwarf galaxies, which is what I had planned to do for my upcoming sabbatical, I would instead spend my sabbatical year traveling through the park system, sharing with people all the different ways that you could experience and see astronomy for yourself. Because right now, when we look at people worldwide, where they are, 50% of the people worldwide now live in cities. And so the estimate is that 50% of the children born this year will probably never see the Milky Way. They'll never see the night sky the way it is supposed to be. And so when you think about the parks, the reason we have the national parks is to preserve these natural places. Well, they aren't just preserving them during the daytime. They're preserving them at night as well. And so these parks have preserved a natural night sky above them. And so my job is to go out there and share with people what it is they're actually seeing.
Because I remember when I was growing up, when we were boys in grade school, when we were children in grade school, this boy that was so fascinated with astronomy, and he had a telescope. And children are naturally curious. And if they don't have an opportunity to be introduced to the night sky, they're going to lose that passion for looking up in the sky and wondering about, as you said, where we come from.
Exactly.
What are we doing here?
Astronomy and dinosaurs. They are the gateway drugs.
That was the other
drugs.
Thing he was the same boy
yes.
was interested in. Astronomy and dinosaurs. I remember that well.
Exactly. They are the gateway drugs for scientists. Every child, when you see a star-filled sky, you cannot help but wonder, what is that? What is out there? And when you see dinosaurs, you can't help but wonder, wow, how big were they? When did they live? When did they die? Why aren't there dinosaurs today? And so it's that questioning, that curiosity, that is the number one skill for a scientist. And it's the reason we named that rover Curiosity that's on Mars right now. So if we didn't have a star-filled sky, if children could not go out and see the sky overhead and see the Milky Way, that first impulse that drives that curiosity, that first question, those won't be there. There will still be scientists, but it'll be so much harder. And you know, who knows where the next Carl Sagan or the next scientist that'll put a rover on Mars will come from.
Yes, so many people were inspired and truly became interested in astronomy because of Carl Sagan. Were you one of those young people?
I was of that generation, exactly. When I was a kid back in, 1980, I would run home from school in order to watch Carl Sagan's Cosmos on TV. And with my allowance, I had bought a copy of the book, and so I would read along with it. And it was my good fortune that 10 years later, I went off to graduate school at Cornell University, where Carl Sagan was a professor. And so I got to meet him in the hallway. And his son was a student of mine that in my astronomy class.
You had Carl Sagan's son in your class?
Oh, believe me, that was a humbling experience.
Oh, my goodness.
I was a first-year teaching assistant. And so I was responsible for giving these classes on the solar system, which was Carl's expertise. And so Carl's son sat there front row center. And he would come to my office hours the next day, and he'd say, you know what? I was talking to my dad last night about something you said in class, and he said it didn't really work the way you described it. In my defense, it was my first semester of ever learning about this material. So, yeah, you learn from the best.
My guest is Tyler Nordgren, and we're talking about his book, Stars Above, Earth Below, A Guide to Astronomy in the National Parks. And you have in your book diagrams, I guess you would call them, where you say if you go out in the night and hold the book up and look, position yourself so the center of this circle, because the sky seems like a bowl over us, that you can, this is like a map that will show you what stars you're seeing when you look up there. And I tried doing that. And here in Chico, of course, we have a lot of light pollution. But I was amazed at how much I could see. Yeah. And it was really exciting.
Yes. It's if you just, you know, people are afraid of things they don't know and don't understand. People are naturally afraid to ask questions or to look dumb. I get so many people say, oh, I'm sure this is going to be a dumb question. No, there are no dumb questions. So one of the things I really try to do with this book is for folks who didn't know what they were seeing up in the sky, I wanted to give them something that you could read along. This is written so you don't have to have a science background to understand this. I wanted to share with people what they could actually see for themselves if they just knew where to go and where to look. So each chapter in the book is a different astronomical phenomenon. Chapter one is the Milky Way. And at the end of each book, I have a little section
called... Each chapter.
Oh, yes. Each chapter, I have a section that says, see for yourself. Here's how to go out and see for yourself the things that we've just talked about in the book. So it's the stars overhead or the geology on the ground. And in that, I hope to make this night sky a much more friendly place.
Because a lot of scientists write for other scientists. And you could have been doing that.
Yep.
But you choose to write for those of us who don't know about astronomy and make it exciting.
Well, I think back to, Carl Sagan when I was a kid in his book Cosmos. That was the thing that made me fall in love with science and dedicate myself to being an astronomer. And I was 10 years old when I read it. And I thought, this is the most exciting thing a person could possibly do with their lives. And so I wanted to give back. I wanted to pass that on to the next generation. And so that's who I wrote this book for.
In fact, I've noticed that astronomers say how much they love what they do. And you're instilling this passion into this next generation because they grew up with technology. And they, for example, when Carl Sagan was putting the Cosmos that was on TV, and that was the technology there. Now this younger generation coming up are accustomed to technology, and who knows how they will be able to use the technology at their fingertips.
Exactly, exactly. The world has changed so much. In one way, it has made it a little bit more difficult, though. When you go out at night and you first look up under a dark sky, your eyes haven't adjusted, and so you don't see much. Astronomy requires patience. You need to wait about 10, 15 minutes for your eyes to really open up. And then you'll see so many things before that you hadn't seen when you first got out there. And one of the problems I've found with some of my students is that they're so eager to turn on the iPhone to find out how long I've been out here. And the instant you do that, it floods your eye with light and you lose sight of what you can see.
My guest has been Tyler Nordgren. He's an astronomer who's written a book, Stars Above, Earth Below, A Guide to Astronomy in the National Parks. Thank you so much, Professor Nordgren.
Oh, thank you for having me.
After a short break, we'll take a look back at the life of rock icon Janis Joplin with her sister, Laura Joplin. This Sunday, the Reading Civic Auditorium is featuring the musical, A Night with Janis Joplin. Over a period of 4 years, Laura Joplin researched and wrote Love, Janis, a biography of her late sister, music legend Janis Joplin. Laura has a master's degree in psychology and a PhD in education, and together with her brother Michael Joplin, oversees their sister's estate. Welcome, Laura.
It's good to be here.
Your book, there's a lot of research that went into this book, I can tell. What did that involve? How did you go about researching for this book?
Well, it's basic academic reading and a lot of interviewing. I actually put miles on our truck, and my husband and our infant daughter drove around the country. I got to talk with neighbors where we grew up and Janice's high school friends and on out into Austin, where, of course, she sang a lot, and then in San Francisco, just tooling the truck around. It was really quite fun.
Because you remember some of it, obviously, yourself, but you were 6 years younger than Janice was. So when I look at all the detail you include, incidents from your childhood, I'm amazed, because if I tried to write all that my own childhood, I couldn't have remembered all that.
Well, I'll tell you, when I first thought about writing, I said, oh, this is great. You know, I'm going to be able to pull up all those things. And I sat down at the typewriter, and I swear I didn't have three pages in my brain. It's just amazing what you don't remember. You have kind of collective photographs, you know, flashes. And so it was about reacquainting myself with the detail of my own life. And that was part of the luxury of the whole thing, to go back and remember the pleasure of the company of your next-door neighbor when you're growing up. You know, how many people get that opportunity? That was really a treat.
And then to find Janice, because you quote Janice's friends all along the way, mm-hmm. was it hard finding them?
Well, you find one, and you end up with all the people they stayed in touch with. So it's just a matter of calling people up and saying, oh, come on, can't you think of anyone you run into? And, you know, pretty soon people are talking, and some people really enjoy reminiscing, and so they're the ones to just get in touch with.
In fact, I thought I would give an opportunity. People here in Chico who went either to the Monterey Pop Festival or to the concert here in Chico when Janice sang here. And they said they really didn't remember that much because they didn't realize at the time that they were participating in an historic event.
Sure. They were just having a good time.
Yeah. And I wondered, too, when you realized that your sister was making history.
Well, I think the emotional impact of her role in people's lives really hit me in 1988 when my brother and I went back to our hometown of Port Arthur, Texas, and they had a memorial celebration. Because up until that time, I had certainly done a lot of caretaking work for her, but it was mostly on the telephone or on paper. And that's a vast difference emotionally than when you're in a room of a few thousand people who are all there to welcome home a girl who essentially put down the entire town, if not the state of Texas, during her public time on the stage. So it was a real emotional homecoming, and it really made me need to know what it was that allowed these people to connect so strongly with her.
Is that when you decided to write the book?
Right. The first chapter of the book was my summary of that weekend's experience. I just wanted to keep all the detail. And after that, then I said, okay, you know, what else is there? You know, what do I want to know? And since at that time I was living in Houston, the easiest thing was to go down to Port Arthur. It's just 90 miles away, and interview all the neighbors and stuff. So that was just the beginning of the odyssey, because wherever I went, the question was always, what's next?
And I'm sure people must wonder what it was like to be the sister of this icon. And to you, of course, she was a sister. And there's a very touching paragraph in your book, early in the book, where you talk about what it's like to have a sister like Janice.
Sure. Let me read a couple of paragraphs here. It would never be enough to say simply that I love Janice. She meant much more to me than that. When I was born, Janice was 6 years old. She took me under her wing as soon as I was able to hobble after her. On the wall of the bedroom we shared, Mother hung pictures of two girls giggling and telling stories to each other. That is how I remember my early years, intertwined with my constant companion and interpreter of the world, my elder sister. She helped me with everything and took me everywhere. In turn, I idolized her. With 6 years difference in age, our daily experiences were often inexplicable to one another. I started grade school when she went on to junior high. I started junior high when she was entering college. I started college when she became the hippie rock and roll queen. So our relationship was never based on sharing the same challenges in life. Our alliance was something more basic, a fundamental trust that continued through all changing circumstances. We talked straight to the core. We shared images, fantasies, and feelings that were like secret rooms that others might not even know existed.
So you had an opportunity to know Janice at that level as a sister. Do you think other people misunderstood her?
Oh, I think that when someone becomes that famous and is cared for by so many people, and you have to realize that when she's that famous at such a turbulent time, there are a lot of people that disliked her, and their images of her are just as powerful in their own memories as are the images of the people that care about her. And so all of those kind of lumped together, maybe they end up with something close to who she is. But for each individual person, they're very distinct. Not any less true for that person, because it's all the emotional power, the memory. I don't want to invalidate that, but who she was when she was a person was her own mix of complexity.
And it seems one of the main things that she wanted to do was to live true to her art. She detested hypocrisy, I got from your book, that was the worst thing somebody could do was to be hypocritical.
It was the ultimate adolescent dirty word. That's what they'd call each other. You know, you hypocrite. You know, so that certainly was what they were aiming for. And they lived in a hypocritical time because they lived and grew up during the days of racial segregation. And it was a huge, hotly debated issue. And we lived in the segregated South. So the fact that they went to a white high school and there was a black high school and, the black part of town didn't have as much prosperity in their homes as the whites did. And there was a clear delineation between who you could talk to and couldn't. That whole sense of hypocrisy takes on a very valid meaning from the racial segregation days. And it just carried forward into discovering, well, who am I? I mean, if I'm not just a white person, I'm now a person. And if black people aren't actually different, you know, then who am I as a woman? You know, who am I in this culture? And it was a real time of transition and wonderful asking of questions.
In fact, one place in your book, you quote her as saying, I'm the first black white woman.
Right, which I love. I like to give that quote a lot. It is a topic, strangely enough, that is seldom, if ever, discussed about her. And the fact that she was a young white girl who sang essentially African-American music and loudly proclaimed the rights of African-Americans, even as early as high school and got in trouble for it, had a band where she put a black man in playing saxophone and openly flaunted those taboos. But it's never continued in her legacy. In her legacy, it's about her untimely death from drugs. It's about her sexual orientation. And it's about her difference in her personal style and image as a woman.
Well, of course, black music appealed to her so much. Mm-hmm. And so she immersed herself in the music of wherever she was, actually, beginning there in Texas, and would some of her, I don't know that I would say heroes, but because she had a lot of musical influences, was certainly blues music from that culture.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she and some friends in high school got fascinated very seriously studying music, and they collected LPs because, you know, at the time, it was hard to come by music, and they would scour and find, and they would stay up at odd hours and listen to the radio stations in Laredo that played the odd music that you couldn't get anywhere. So they considered themselves connoisseurs and kind of like investigators, and African-American music was one piece. And again, it's part of the fact that the entire black culture in our hometown was off limits. Mm-hmm. And these kids wanted to know what it was about. And they read beatnik literature, which of course was often about the black jazz musician and that lifestyle. So they were very curious, and jazz was a part of it. Some of her friends were jazz musicians. And Janice was into Lead Belly. She was into Bessie Smith, Ma Rainey, Mahalia Jackson, Pearl Bailey, all tremendous black vocalists.
You mentioned Janice getting into trouble, but that didn't bother her. I mean, she was fearless. I really came to admire how bold and fearless she was in living her life. And if it involved getting into trouble or stepping on toes, then that was okay with her.
She said, don't compromise yourself, because yourself is all you got. And she did live that way. She did blurt out what she thought, and no consideration for the repercussions. But that's not to say that the repercussions did not affect her and hurt her. They did, certainly in high school. I think that when she finally became this rock sensation and this leader of this alternative culture, you know, she could, you know, almost not believe it. It's like, wow, I really am right, you know, and look, everybody's following me. She wrote a song once about, you know, being the Pied Piper, and lo and behold, she became the Pied Piper.
At one point, you quote your mother as advising Janice, think before you speak, but if she did, she would still say the same thing probably, don't you think?
That's a good point, yeah, she might have.
Well, because of all these, and she majored in art when she went to college, she was very interested in art, so she was a painter as well as a music form of art. And, of course, I think everybody begins to notice when Janice becomes famous after the Monterey Pop Festival. And the Big Brother and the Holding Company. Of course, Janice has a lot of musical influences up to this time, but this is really a very condensed period when you think about the time that she, from the time she graduated high school and became this world-famous icon, was really a very short period. But after Cheap Thrills came out, then the whole world knew about it. There's a section in your book, if you would read, because your book is called Love Janice, and this is one of the, and this was a rather short note from Janice when Puerto Rico. Would you read that part?
Sure. July 1968. Dear family, had to write you a card from Puerto Rico. So far, all I've seen, unfortunately, is the inside of three hotels and a short stretch of beach, but lots of free rum punch on Columbia. We play tonight and leave tomorrow morning for Newport, but at least I'll get to see the island from the air. Special note to Mike, honey, just congratulations and pride and all the love I have for your work in Agape, which is a newspaper Michael and his friend Jimmy Pryor put out, particularly the poem, Oh, So Fine, I Have It on My Wall. Love to everyone, Janice. The self and the public image blended more in those days, explained Bennett Glotzer, Albert's one-time partner. Yes?
I did want to mention, you mentioned Columbia, and that was Columbia Records, because they put out the album Cheap Thrills. It skyrocketed to the top of the charts. So she says, thanks to Columbia, all this is on Columbia. And then Michael, of course, is her brother,
right.
Your brother, that she mentions there and saying, great, keep up the good work. She encouraged him as a poet. And then what else?
Well, it's also interesting to note that this letter is written in July of 68, and the Cheap Thrills album actually was not released and hit the charts until August of 68. So her entire career and fame was built almost on word of mouth. It was not built on record sales. They were touring some, for sure, but Big Brother and Janice, largely, had this incredible effect on people. So what, you want me to read some more here?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, the self and the public image blended more in those days, explained Bennett Glotzer, Albert Grossman's one-time partner, who was her manager. Bennett saw the world mostly according to business loyalties. Stars used to hang out in public, meeting at designated gathering places. Everybody wore the same clothes on the street that they wore on stage. Janice was the same as her audience. She shared the same taste in clothes, drink, and musical entertainment. Her popular acceptance wouldn't have been possible had her public persona not been based on some true aspect of her personality. It was part of her, but she seemed to begin to believe it was all of her. Instantly, she had become the subject of constant press observation. Janice always had to be on because someone was always there observing. If you practice long enough being a big, brassy blues bomber, Bobby Newer said, you become one. You start to expect it of yourself just as others expect it of you. For me, Janice explained to the press, lifestyle and singing are the same.
And you mentioned that this was before really the record came out, that they just word of mouth became, Big Brother and the Holding Company with Janice featured, became so popular. And how could that be? What was it? Janice felt there was an energy. There was something, and you have a paragraph about that in your book, too, about how Janis felt on stage and how powerful that was. Could you read that section?
Is that here?
Janis had it's on page 278.
Right. Janis had some rough moments, but her time on stage was still driving her life. I do believe in some very amorphous things that happen when you're on stage, like something moves in the air, Janis tried to explain to the interviewer from the Los Angeles Times West magazine, Rasa Gustaitis. It seems like a real thing that moves around in the air. It's non-existent, but it's so real it's like love or desire. You know damn well it's there. You know it's right there, man, and something's gonna go. Rasa became a friend after this interview. Janis liked her questions so much. Rasa called Janis a shaman woman, wailing as though possessed. Rasa quoted a fan who was later echoed by fan letters sent after Janis's death. She's us. She's not a star. She's us. I've never met her, but I know her. It's like hearing her. You leave your body and you just move, man. She's just all energy. I don't know. She's all of us. It was beginning to seem as if the only time Janis was herself was on stage. Off stage, a personal duality arose that made little sense. It didn't feel as real as the locked-in vibes of the audience trance. She explained, I'm full of emotion and want a release. And if you're on stage and it's really working and you've got the audience with you, it's a oneness you feel. I'm into me plus they're into me, and everything comes together. The fans got so into Janis and the band that they began storming the stage. The first time was in Cleveland, where people ran through the band while they were playing a song and began trying to pull the bangles off Janis's arm. She was shocked and startled, saying, "What are you doing? I'm trying to sing." Performing with Janis was an adrenaline-raising thing, James Gurley said. I would never be able to go to sleep till past dawn. And so there was always wanting something that would cool you out. Janis faced the question of how to re-enter the everyday world after her shamanic ecstasies on stage. Alcohol was always her drug of choice, her friends individually reported to me. Janis favored Rainier Ale when Linda Gravenites first met her, and that evolved into Southern Comfort. Alcohol was a social drug. People went out and had a drink together. As her career advanced, Janis's comfort in the general social realm seemed to diminish correspondingly with her need to be her public image. Every alcoholic, and surely Janis became one, has this thing, explained Bobby North. She told him, someday they're going to find out that I don't really know what I'm doing. And she once whispered to Linda, what if they find out I'm only Janis?
I'm sure there's so many people, whether they'll admit it or not, have that feeling. What if people find out I'm not the what they think I am?
Sure.
And she expressed that.
Mm-hmm. We're all pushing ourselves. Yeah, certainly, you know, she talked at one point about going upstairs and putting Janis Joplin on because she kept her in a box as her costume, you know. Mm-hmm. She was definitely having identity issues.
But this energy that you mentioned or that you described that she talked about, that's what people who went to the concert seem to remember. They might not remember the details, but they remember that energy of being at that concert and the way everybody was so involved. And of course, she you couldn't not be involved.
Yeah, the guys in Big Brother once said that that Janis had been great in the dances and the gigs they did before the Monterey International Pop Festival, but there was something about being in front of that huge crowd with all those performers that she just became someone else. She lit up on stage, and she became the performer that we later recognize as Janis.
In fact, she has been the inspiration for a lot of different art forms. One of them is a musical. Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting, in a way you can say that Janis wrote a musical because the words from your book were used as the script, I understand.
Right. Every word that's spoken on stage is taken either from an interview or a letter home or a letter to her friends or lovers. So I like to think that Janis gets to come back and tell her own story.
Yeah, so this is a musical that that you, I'm sure they consulted you and got permission. So there's the book Love, Janis by Laura Joplin, and there's also the musical Love, Janis now.
Right, by Randy Myler. Yeah, it's a wonderful, good, kicking, jumping up and down, good time.
Yeah, the reviews I've read have been really fantastic. So I'm sure Janis would be pleased.
Yeah, I like to think so.
I like to think so, too. Now, Janis, I think one of the main things that is known about Janis, of course, is her dramatic exit from this life. And we, the part that you were just reading, the role that alcohol played, a very large part of it, and heroin from time to time, speed. But at the time, nobody knew that, I mean, speed was not really, really the hazards of it weren't known. So some of these things that she was experimenting with were not considered as dangerous. Although, although a friend of hers said that Janis seemed to know she was going to die young.
Oh, people look back and see predictions all the time. Janis had come home having been strung out on crystal meth before she ever heard of psychedelics and Big Brother and the Holding Company.
Was that when she got down to 88 pounds?
88 pounds. And she was terrified and clearly was working to put herself back together. So you will read in a lot of her letters home where she's telling the parents, don't worry about me. I'm fine. My head's together. I haven't lost weight. I haven't gained weight. Everything's... So she is trying to assure them, and she is trying to monitor her drug use. You can tell in the photos taken of her how healthy she was in the 66 photos when she first got out there. And then as she used different drugs, her weight would go up and down. She never got back into speed. She did regrettably get into heroin. But, you know, it was a wacky time when people thought there was something righteous about changing your sense of reality, which is wonderful, I think, if you do it within a self-knowledge, a spiritual awareness of some sort. But you don't need drugs to do that, and drugs take you places you can't necessarily control. And certainly for a lot of people, they become addictive.
Well, after Janis, she died in Los Angeles, and her home, her house was in San Francisco. And when you and the first, your parents came to San Francisco, you and your brother were still in Texas at the time. And it wasn't until the party that Janis had provided the funding for in her will that you came to San Francisco. Can you find that part in the book where you went to Janis's house?
This is
early in the book. Yeah, page 5.
When Bob Gordon, who was Janis's executor and her attorney, when Bob asked me to come to Janis's party, I didn't delay in saying, yes, I'll come. I never hesitated in going. I had to see what it was like out there and who those people were. I needed to touch her house and her things and find bits of her life that I hadn't known from my vantage in Texas. Janice's house was half empty when I arrived on October 25th, as she had left her possessions to her friends. Many had already come by to claim an oriental rug, a carved cherry cabinet, and other special items. Bob gallantly explained that he figured sisters were friends too, and that if I saw anything I wanted to keep, I should tell him. The furniture was already promised, her roommate Lyndall Erb explained, so I searched among the remaining trivia. I found my keepsake, a silver-plated cigarette lighter I had given Janis for her birthday. It had embossed roses around its oval belly. It was heavy in my hand, and the weight felt good. Lyndall said it was broken, as though, who would want that? I didn't even smoke. I didn't need the fire, just the warmth of the connection. A gift from me to Janis, and now from Janis to me. Janis's California crew didn't know what to do with me, but they did put me up in her house. Lyndall Erb had moved into Janice's bedroom after she died. Lyndall went through the pretense of offering to move out so I could stay there. I declined, saying the bed in the living room was fine for me. Arriving at the party at the Lion's Share in San Anselmo on October 26, I sat amid people trying to force themselves to be jovial, but they naturally turned to quiet conversations about who was doing what. Someone next to me eagerly pointed out the tie-dyed satin sheet that hung behind a pickup band of friends playing on stage. They crowed that a recent lover of Janice's had torn that big hole in it while in the midst of passion because he'd kept his cowboy boots on. Several people pushed renowned tattoo artist Lyle Tuttle to take his shirt off and show me his tattooed torso. He and I agreed that we didn't think it was necessary. Someone offered me a brownie, and I was eager for some food, having eaten little at dinner. Only later did he mention that they were hashish brownies. The air was getting thick inside my head, and I beat a hasty retreat on the arms of Bob Gordon and John Cook, Janice's lanky and amiable road manager, an Easterner who had refashioned himself in Western garb. I reached the sidewalk in the cool night air just in time to throw up on John Cook's left booth. I thought it couldn't get much worse.
So that's your experience of going to, this was in later in that month after Janice had died, and going and meeting some of her friends.
Right.
But there were friends that had rather mystical experiences after Janice died. And just briefly, because we are running out of time now, Laura, this is Laura Joplin. We're talking about her book, Love Janice. And some of her friends were comforted by their experiences after Janice died.
Well, Bob Gordon in particular had an afternoon encounter discussion with her, just a feeling of warmth and a sense that she was fine, she was okay, and life was good where she was. And those types of things really seemed to make people feel more accepting about their loss.
And there were several of these friends. Some of them said they heard the phone ringing. Another one said it was like a vision or a dream that Janice seemed to be comforting her friends in that way. What do you want the world? Because this is a continuing process. I mean, this is a career for you managing Janice's second career, because her first career is the famous one. But what do you see as your role continuing to help the world to know Janice?
Well, I think that my responsibility is to try to help provide quality materials, information, music, projects that help people connect with a woman who's affected them. And it's an incredible pleasure for me to have the opportunity to say hello and to hear from them and to know that she lives in many different ways in their hearts.
And certainly in your book. And I think those of us of a certain generation just really enjoy and appreciate what you have written. The book is Love Janice. I've been talking to Janice's sister, Laura Joplin. I'm Nancy Wiegman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.